Hey, everybody. It's Lisa Desjardins, correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. I want to let you know about a special podcast episode that explores something probably most of us are struggling with as the coronavirus pandemic wears on, an overwhelming feeling of isolation. We asked about the ways your day-to-day life has changed and the ways we're all still trying to connect. To listen, head over to the PBS NewsHour full show podcast feed in Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff. On the NewsHour tonight, another week in a changed world. Global deaths surpass 100,000 as Americans reel from the dual health and economic crises. And small business owners struggle to hold on as COVID-19 bears down. Then Senator Bernie Sanders on his withdrawal from the Democratic presidential primary and the challenge the nation faces with the epidemic. Plus, on Good Friday, we examine Holy Week during a pandemic as Pope Francis celebrates in a vacant Vatican. And it's Friday. Mark Shields and David Brooks analyze the latest on the pandemic. And this week, when thoughts turn to Easter, Passover, and a role for faith. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by economy for 160 years. BNSF, the engine that connects us.
Consumer Cellular offers no-contract wireless plans that are designed to help you do more of the things you enjoy. Whether you're a talker, texter, browser, photographer, or a bit of everything, our U.S.-based customer service team is here to find a plan that fits you. To learn more, go to consumercellular.tv.
Financial services firm, Raymond James.
John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, fostering informed and engaged communities. More at kf.org.
And with the ongoing support of these institutions. And friends of the NewsHour. This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
The coronavirus pandemic has reached a deadly new high just over 4 months after it began. The worldwide death toll passed 100,000 today. That figure includes some 18,000 deaths in the United States, nearly double from a week ago. Meanwhile, President Trump is talking anew of restarting the economy, but says that he will listen to his health advisors. John Yang begins our coverage.
At the end of the week that officials predicted would be the height of the crisis, Dr. Anthony Fauci said things are improving.
We're starting to see the leveling off and the coming down.
But he cautioned that whenever restrictions are relaxed, coronavirus cases are likely to increase.
When we decide at a proper time when we're going to be relaxing some of the restrictions, there's no doubt you're going to see cases. I would be so surprised if we did not see cases. The question is how you respond to them.
President Trump said he would form a new task force to get the nation back to business as soon and as safely as possible.
We're looking at a date. We hope we're going to be able to fulfill a certain date, but we're not doing anything until we know that this country is going to be healthy.
In hard-hit New York, for the first time since the beginning of the outbreak, the state reported today a net decline in intensive care unit admissions, mirroring a pattern also seen in another hot spot, California. Governor Gavin Newsom warned it's not time for his state to let its guard down.
Let's continue to hold the line. And let's just do this together. Give us a few more weeks to see where these trend lines go, and then we'll be talking a lot more.
In Los Angeles, Mayor Eric Garcetti's order took effect today, mandating that shoppers wear masks in places like grocery stores and pharmacies, an effort to protect essential retail workers. Overnight, frontline workers were honored in cities like New York, Dallas, and Chicago, which lit up their skylines in blue.
I want to thank you for your hospitality today.
In Washington, D.C., which is bracing for a likely surge in COVID-19 cases, the mayor asked churches to move their Easter services online.
I want to thank all of our faith communities and religious leaders who are helping us save lives by taking their services online and encouraging members of their congregations to celebrate at home.
From Australia to the Philippines, many faithful turn to online Good Friday services, including the Mass Pope Francis said in a mostly empty St. Peter's Basilica. But in Dusseldorf, Germany, parishioners took things offline, gathering at a drive-in movie theater for a ceremony that, even with worshipers in their vehicles, brought back the feeling of togetherness they had been yearning for.
In the current times, this is a unique opportunity to be with the parish instead of at home. We're here with friends. There are friends all over here in their cars, and we think it's amazing to have the chance to celebrate together. Certainly unforgettable.
Meanwhile, European Union finance ministers agreed to a $590 billion package to combat the unprecedented economic fallout of the pandemic. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
This week, the Democratic primary election took a momentous turn as Senator Bernie Sanders announced he is suspending his presidential campaign. The senator from Vermont joins me now. Welcome to the NewsHour. Senator, you said on Wednesday when you made the announcement you were doing this in part because of the pandemic. And as you said, it would be difficult to continue under the circumstances. Today, you announced a proposal to guarantee health care during this period. Who is this aimed at?
Well, it's aimed at the tens of millions of workers who are losing their jobs, Judy. And when you lose your jobs, you lose your health care. So on top of 87 million people who were uninsured and underinsured before the crisis, you got tens of millions more who are not going to have any health insurance. And it's my view that in the midst of this terrible, terrible crisis, when people have so much to worry about, the least we can do is to say to all of those people, you know what, you go to the doctor when you're sick, don't worry about the health care bills. Medicare will fill in all the gaps and cover those people who are uninsured or underinsured today.
And do you have support for this among Democratic colleagues?
Yes, we do. There's support in the House, and I think you're going to see growing support in the Senate. And I think that the cost is reasonable. It'll be about $150 billion over 4 months, which, given everything that we're dealing with, is not a lot of money. But to say to every American that don't worry about the cost of health care, you're not going to have to pay it out of your own pocket, you're not going to have to pay for prescription drugs, I think that will take a huge burden off the shoulders of so many of our people, and that is the very least that we should be doing right now.
Senator, let's talk about this election. What, after 15 months of pour your heart out campaigning, and this after you spent, years campaigning in 2016, you've had to make this this announcement that you didn't want to make. This is not where you wanted this to end up. But as you look back, what went right and what went wrong?
Well, look, I think that what went right is that for all intent and purposes, Judy, I think we have won the ideological battle. I think ideas that I fought for 4 or 5 years ago, which everybody considered to be radical and extreme, are now part of the mainstream discussion. And in fact, many of them are being implemented all across this country, raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, making public colleges and universities tuition-free, forgiving student debt, guaranteeing health care to all people as a human right, focusing on climate change, as an existential threat, immigration reform, criminal justice reform. Many of the ideas that we brought forth, which were initially rejected, are now moving forward. And I think that is the best thing that we have accomplished. Furthermore, we have won the generational struggle. We did very poorly, and I don't know why, to tell you the truth, with older people. But we have done phenomenally well with younger people. And by that, I mean people 45, 50, or younger. And the truth is, that is the future of America. So the ideas that we have fought for are gaining momentum among younger people and will be the policies that guide America in the future.
Senator, I think I was just going to say, I think the numbers show you didn't do as well with young people as you had in 2016. But what I want to ask you about is you are supporting, at least you acknowledge Joe Biden will be the nominee, and yet you're going to compete against him in the primaries to come. What is the value of that?
No, we're not competing against, there's no active campaigning. There's nothing to compete about. Joe Biden will, everything being equal, be the nominee. But I think my name will be on the ballot. That's the way it is in all of the remaining states that hold primaries. We would like to get as many delegates as we can so that we have a stronger position at the Democratic convention to help us shape the new platform of the Democratic Party and other issues that the DNC deals with.
You say you want to shape the platform, and yet I think it appears from the last many conventions, it's what the nominee wants that ultimately matters. And right now, Joe Biden has moved in your direction. He's talked about lowering the age for Medicare eligibility to 60. He's talked about making free college tuition more available. But at the same time, he has not endorsed Medicare for All. Senator Sherrod Brown, liberal Democrat, was on the program two nights ago, said he doesn't think that Joe Biden is going to do that. Is that sufficient for you?
Well, look, Judy, what I said on the very first day that I began my campaign, I said that if I lose, I will be there to support the Democratic winner, the nominee, the person who wins the nomination, because I think that Donald Trump is the most dangerous president in the modern history of this country, and we all have got to rally around the winner to defeat Trump. And that's certainly what I will do. But I hope in the coming weeks and months, I will be working and my staff will be working with Joe Biden and his team in making the point that if Joe is going to do well against Trump and he's going to defeat Trump, then he is going to have to reach out effectively to a whole lot of people where he has not had the kind of support that he needs. And that's lower income people, that is younger people. And he's going to have to give those people the understanding that he hears them and he's moving to respond to their concerns. And that deals with climate change. It deals with making public colleges and universities tuition free. In my view, it deals with, you're right, he is not going to support Medicare for all. But I think there is a significant path forward for him to make sure that when so many people are losing their private insurance, that the federal government will be there for them to cover their healthcare needs.
You have said that you campaigned enthusiastically for Hillary Clinton 4 years ago. Will you do exactly the same for Joe Biden? Will you be more enthusiastic? Because as you know, many Democrats look back and say they wished you'd done more.
Well, many Democrats opposed me from the Democratic establishment from day one. All I can tell you is in 2016, I worked as hard as I could to see that Trump was defeated and Clinton was elected.
And will this year be different?
Well, this year I will work as hard as I can to make sure that Donald Trump is not reelected and that Joe Biden becomes president. But I hope in the interval here, what we have got to do is, and I think, you know, Joe Biden not only is he a decent guy, he is a good politician. And he understands that for him to win, to get the votes that he needs, he's going to have to listen to and respond to the needs of a whole lot of people who have not been overly enthusiastic about his campaign up to now.
But you're saying you will be enthusiastically supporting him. A key decision that he's going to have to make, of course, is for vice president. He has said he will choose a woman. Let me ask you how your supporters would view it if he chose Elizabeth Warren.
Well, I think
I can't speak for all of my supporters. All I can say is that I think the more progressive the vice presidential candidate that he nominated, the better it would be in terms of the kind of response that our supporters would provide him.
So if it were Amy Klobuchar?
I can't speculate on that.
Or
Joe is going to have to make that decision himself. I have not been involved in that discussion. We'll see what he does.
Republicans, Senator, this week in Wisconsin, as you know, took steps to prevent measures that would have made it easier for people to vote, to either delay the election or to make it mail-in ballots possible. That view is also held by Republicans at the national level. How concerned are you right now about November and access to ballots, access to voting for Americans across the board?
Judy, I will tell you, I don't know that I have ever, within a political context, seen anything as ugly as the role that the Republicans in the legislature in Wisconsin and their Supreme Court played in terms of this primary. What they essentially said to people is, you're going to have to put your life on the line in order to cast a ballot. And that is just unbelievably disgraceful. And that is not what we can allow to happen in future elections. So it is a very, very high priority for me, and I think for many other Democrats, as we go forward on the new piece of legislation. I've got a lot of ideas on that one, but certainly one of the highest priorities must be to make sure that every American in this country is able to vote through a paper ballot in November. And the Republicans, I must say, have been pretty clear. They understand that if there is a large voter turnout, they're not going to do so well, and they're fighting us. But I hope their respect for our Constitution, for our democracy, will prevail, and they will understand that people should not have to die or get sick in order to cast a ballot.
Very quickly.
I should also tell you that in terms of the new legislation, we're working very hard, not only to make sure that all people have health care, but that people will continue to get their paychecks. I think that is the easiest, most efficient way to get us out of this economic disaster that we're in right now. Just making sure that every American continues to receive his or her paycheck will go a long way to allowing Americans to have a decent standard of living so long as we're in this crisis.
Final question, and quickly, Senator, who leads the progressive movement that Bernie Sanders started next? Who are the next leaders of your movement?
You're asking me to speculate. I'm not much into speculation, but what I will say is right now, literally as we speak, I've been on the phone with progressives all across this country, figuring out the best way that we can keep our kind of unprecedented grassroots movement strong and growing. So we are a strong movement, and history will determine what happens in the future. But right now, we are working hard to build that movement.
Senator Bernie Sanders joining us tonight from Vermont. Senator, thank you very much.
Thank you, Judy.
In the day's other news, members of the OPEC oil cartel, along with Russia and Mexico, agreed to cut global production by up to 10 million barrels a day. That amounts to a tenth of the world oil supply in an effort to boost oil prices and stabilize global oil markets. The price of crude oil has fallen more than 50% since the start of the year. U.S. Attorney General William Barr says that he believes the investigation into President Trump and his campaign for Russia ties was a travesty. In an interview that aired on Fox News last night, Barr said the FBI never should have begun the investigation in the first place.
Without any basis, they started this investigation of his campaign. And even more concerning, actually, is what happened after the campaign, a whole pattern of events while he was president. So to sabotage the presidency.
Barr gave no details, but he had already ordered a review of how the Russia probe investigation began. A Justice Department inspector general has determined that the FBI was justified in launching the probe. As the coronavirus pandemic gains momentum on the continent of Africa, Ebola resurfaced today in Congo. Health officials reported that a man died after being infected. It was the first new case there in more than 7 weeks, and it came just days before Congo leaders had aimed to declare the outbreak ended. It began in August 2018, and it has killed more than 2,200 people. And in East Africa, vast swarms of locusts are devastating crops and threatening millions of people with hunger. The first wave weeks ago was the worst in 70 years. Now, a second wave, 20 times bigger, is sweeping across Kenya and other countries. Billions of insects are filling fields and covering trees, threatening rural communities. Officials say restrictions related to the COVID-19 pandemic have delayed critical aerial spraying. Still to come on the NewsHour, feeling the pain, small businesses struggle to get government support before they face collapse. Holy Week amid a pandemic, Pope Francis celebrates in a vacant Vatican. Mark Shields and David Brooks analyze another week under social distance, and a recipe for coping with cookbook author Ina Garten.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The economic emergency that's tied directly to the pandemic is especially brutal for small businesses all over the country. In many cases, some owners are beginning to face questions this spring about whether their business can survive. Amna Nawaz has more on the storm of troubles people are facing.
A sudden and complete drop in business has left many businesses struggling without sales or income. The government is trying to help. As part of a $2 trillion aid package signed into law by the president and Congress, nearly $350 billion will be used to ensure banks provide loans and loan forgiveness for small businesses. But small business owners say they're having major trouble getting their loan applications moving through banks and the Small Business Administration, or SBA, which helps to coordinate those federal funds. Here's what a few small business owners shared with us.
My name is Justin Moore. I'm the general manager of Uncle Bobby's Coffee and Books in Germantown, Philadelphia. Like most retail spaces, it's been a bit of a nightmare since the middle of last month. The biggest pain point for me since we closed our doors is just worrying about everyone's well-being, not just from a health standpoint, but, you know, financially as well. And, you know, we have these recurring expenses, these bills, including rent and insurance, that we have no way of being able to pay without some assistance from the SBA.
My name is Greg Honeycutt, and our company is Honeycutt Construction and Design in Houston, Texas. We bank with Wells Fargo. You know, all they communicated to me after I registered was, we're still not ready to actually do the application process. Please don't contact us again.
My name is Travis Powell, and I own the Best Western Plus Frontier Motel in Lone Pine, California. It's a small town of 2,000 people, and both of our banks, neither one of which is affiliated with the SBA in any way. And Saturday morning, I sat down and sent out either 32 applications and or contact forms filled out online. I've heard back from about half of those, and they all state the same thing, that at this time, we're only servicing people with existing loans or existing accounts.
My name is Christine Goslin, and I have owned my salon since 2002. I had called our bank, and I was told that there were over 400 applications. And at this point, I would be on a wait list. I could get by clearly this month and maybe next month. But I did tell my husband that if we're out through May and into June, I might have to start looking for some sort of job.
I am Jennifer Myers Polidori, owner of Myers of Keswick, a British specialty food store in Greenwich Village, Manhattan, New York. I have tried, I guess you can say, since Friday, April 3rd, to apply for the SBA loan. Basically, the biggest challenge has been trying to actually get through and click submit so that I know that my application has gone through?
We're running out of money rapidly. I'm in the process of using the CARES Act to borrow from my 401k, and that'll allow me to pay my employees for about a month more. They're at part-time right now being paid.
So we have four full-time employees. I paid them for 2 weeks. That was 2 weeks ago. We're in week three now. I have not paid them this week.
I understand that, you know, things are going to be slow because we're dealing with some extenuating circumstances, but at this point, almost a month after we've closed, I need some type of timetable at this point.
You know that you're kind of in a race to fill this out and get this application submitted, and you think you're moving along, and then boom, you get bumped out. So you wonder how many people actually got to click submit before you. And it's very daunting. I've lost a bit of sleep over it.
That loan program they mentioned is known as the Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP. Businesses with fewer than 500 workers can qualify. They can use that money to pay for up to 2 months of payroll, leases, and utilities, and those loans, in some cases, can be forgiven. We're going to talk through all the details of that program and what businesses are facing right now with Lisa Desjardins, who joins me now. Lisa, you can hear in their voices the anxiety, the concern, the worry. How representative are some of those stories with what's happening across the board right now?
Amna, I and our team have been talking to a lot of small businesses, and those are completely representative of what's happening. Essentially, there is a massive bottleneck in trying to get this money. Incredible demand and not the ability to get it out. Let's look at the specific issues of what's happening. Right at the front of it, banks are limiting these loans. That in part is because some large corporate banks feel they're under constraints, and some smaller banks are worried about their balance sheet, that they can't handle as much of the volume as the demand entails. Now, also part of this, Amna, however, is that banks are not getting very much specific guidance from the government as to exactly who qualifies for these loans. The nitty-gritty details that they need, they say they're not getting. So all of this, Amna, has led to long waits, sometimes a wait just to get your application in, much less to know if your application has been approved.
You know, Lisa, navigating a federal process, even without a global pandemic going on, can be a frustrating process. How much of that bottleneck is due to the fact that this is just unprecedented, this kind of program at this kind of scale?
Yeah, that's the right question. Absolutely. That is part of the problem. No country, certainly not the U.S., has ever tried something like this before. I want to convey what this program looks like, so a sense of scope of all of this. So the total program, as you've reported, is about $349 billion in funding. That's been approved so far. Now, just in the past 2 weeks that it's been in existence, I'm told as of today, some $151 billion has been approved for small businesses. So consider this, Amna. All of last year, the SBA loaned out only $28 billion. So they've, in the course of the last 2 weeks, loaned out five times what they did all of last year. So this is unprecedented, and it's fair to say that they're working as hard as they can. But Amna, there are others who say the SBA and Congress itself should have thought about this a month ago, 6 weeks ago, when they knew an economic tsunami was coming.
Yeah, Lisa, you hear even in the stories of the folks who sent in their experiences with us, there's a diversity of experience. There's variation in their stories, right? And when you think about who has access to capital markets and to financing, even again, when pandemics aren't going on, that varies, whether you're a minority-owned business, whether you're a rural business. Is any of the recovery effort geared towards that, towards evening out some of those inequities?
No, not yet. And that's something that's really been discussed. I think that right now, this is an untested program. It's not clear where the problems are. That's why we're reporting on it right now. But you could hear in those stories the diversity of experience from the construction owner and salon owner who had applied and were just waiting in a very long line to hear from their banks, to Travis. He was the hotel owner in rural America who really wasn't sure he could find a bank that would support him because so many banks, Amna, have limited this loan only to their current customers. And many banks in rural America don't carry SBA loans. They're not part of this process usually. So that has left rural America especially sort of in a tougher position than others.
So Lisa, what about Congress? What are they working on? Is there more potential help on the way?
There is. There is talk. Everyone agrees in Washington that this more money is needed for this. They disagree about how to divide it. The president wants $250 billion more just in general for small businesses. Democrats want it to be targeted to community banks, especially those rural ones, and for disaster loans and assistance. But I want to give people a sense of sort of how this all works or where we're at. So for small businesses, here's why this matters so much. 48% of this nation's workers work for small businesses, and 90% of them told the National Federation of Independent Business, a major small business group, 90% said that they are experiencing an impact from the coronavirus. That's a huge surge in just the last couple of weeks. Moreover, Amna, most of them told the NFIB that they don't think they can survive 2 months without any help. And so what's happening, Amna, is this is a situation where there is an economic curve as much as there is a healthcare curve. And if there is not help for these businesses, just in the next couple of weeks, we could see some businesses that just feel they might have to turn to bankruptcy. So the time is very critical for many of these businesses.
Time is very critical. That help is critically needed, too. Lisa Desjardins reporting for us tonight. Thanks, Lisa.
You're welcome.
Today, on Good Friday, the Italian Prime Minister announced a further lockdown of his stricken nation until at least May 4th. And in Israel, a nationwide stay-at-home order remains in effect. With empty streets in Rome and the sacred sites of the old city of Jerusalem, special correspondent Sabina Castelfranco reports on a very different Holy Week.
Holy Week at the Vatican this year. No faithful, no tourists, only the police making sure not a soul breaks the rules. Everyone here must stay indoors to stop the spread of COVID-19. Authorities are taking no chances, and after weeks of mounting dead, the five-week lockdown appears to be working. The number of newly infected is declining. The streets of the Eternal City lie empty, nearly devoid of life. Famous landmarks like the Colosseum and the Trevi Fountain deserted. The Vatican, too, has had a small number infected inside its walls and adopted similar distancing measures. As the crisis peaked, Pope Francis delivered an extraordinary and stark Urbi et Orbi message to Rome and the world.
We have realized we are in the same boat, all of us fragile and disoriented, but at the same time important and needed, all of us called to row together.
Palm Sunday is the start of Holy Week, and St. Peter's Square is normally packed with tens of thousands, waving palm fronds and olive branches. But not this year. Inside St. Peter's Basilica, Pope Francis and attendants celebrated a lonely mass.
The tragedy we are experiencing in these days summons us to take serious the things that are serious and not be caught up in those that matter less.
Pope Francis decided that all Holy Week ceremonies this year would be held behind closed doors inside St. Peter's Basilica, except for one, the Way of the Cross. That solemn moment recounts Jesus' death by crucifixion more than 2,000 years ago.
The Way of the Cross candlelit procession is traditionally held at Rome's ancient Colosseum and attended by thousands of faithful. This year, Pope Francis prayed in an empty St. Peter's Basilica, the 83-year-old Pope, alone. In Jerusalem, normally packed streets of the old city lie eerily deserted. Here, along these ancient stone paths, Jesus is said to have walked and suffered the 14 stations of the cross on the Via Dolorosa, or painful path to crucifixion. Today in Jerusalem, only a few friars walked the path in a procession usually marked by thousands of pilgrims.
Now it is,
Father Francesco Patton lamented the loss, but saw meaning in the struggles of so many.
And when I think to those who are in the hospitals and in the houses fighting with coronavirus, in some way they are walking a very hard and personal Via Dolorosa.
This year, the devoted are nowhere to be seen, as Israel has gone into total lockdown. Israel controls most access to the Old City and its sites sacred to Christians, Muslims, and Jews, who began celebrating Passover this week, marking the hope of rebirth and their ancient deliverance from slavery in Egypt to freedom. And in this Old City, the beating heart of three faiths, only the cats remain. At the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, built over the spot where Jesus Christ was said to have been crucified and buried, the ancient doors closed for the first time in nearly 700 years, since the Black Plague. In Paris today, the city's Archbishop Michel Aupetit celebrated Mass in the charred hulk of Notre Dame nearly a year after the cathedral burned.
Today, we are in this half-fallen cathedral to say that life still exists.
A crown of thorns, as Jesus is said to have worn on the cross, rescued after the fire, lay on a makeshift altar.
It's a magnificent symbol that tells us that you will accompany us in the height of our suffering.
Easter Sunday at the Vatican normally marks the holiest day in the Christian calendar, as the faithful the world over celebrate the resurrection of Jesus. This year it will be different in St. Peter's Square as Pope Francis delivers his message of hope and renewal to a world in sore need of both. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Sabina Castelfranco in Rome.
And now it's time for the analysis of Shields and Brooks. That is syndicated columnist Mark Shields and New York Times columnist David Brooks. Hello to both of you. Here we are, what is it, 3 weeks, Mark, since the first stay-at-home order. The United States is now, by the count we see, has almost one-third the cases of coronavirus of the entire world total. How is the U.S. doing in this fight?
I think the U.S. is adjusting collectively to a new reality, a terrible reality. As Herodotus said several thousand years ago, character is destiny. We're seeing character. We're seeing leadership. We're seeing society's heroes change from investment bankers and leverage buyout artists. All of a sudden, people stop and applaud hospital workers and nurses and doctors and firefighters and emergency people. That's a change. It's a recognition of the importance of what people. It's a recognition of what grocery store workers do to keep our country going. The sacrifices that so many people are making are truly breathtaking and admirable. And I think that to me has been the signal characteristic.
And David, how would you say the country's doing, both at the federal level and at the state level?
I'd say we're hanging in there. You don't get a sense of great competence and expertise at the federal level. You do get a little more of that at the state level. The debts are mounting. The economy is really crashing down around us. I'm focused on mental health these days. I asked 6,000 of my New York Times readers to write to me about how their mental health was doing. And I was gutted by their responses. People are really hurting. There are three groups in particular. Young people just feeling their hopes and dreams are dashed. And there's a sense of hopelessness, not eating, not sleeping, crying on the sofa. Senior citizens also very badly hit, especially widows and widowers, just that sense of just crushing isolation. And then those with mental health problems, or those who already had mental health problems, who are now seeing these relapses. And so there's another curve, a mental health curve. And yet I think America is still hanging together. Faith in our institutions is pretty good. There's nobody rioting in the streets. There's nobody looting. There's nobody saying we've got to do anything but what we've got to do, which is just hunker down.
And Mark, do you see the scaffolding in place, the infrastructure, whatever you want to call it, the support systems in place to help people at this moment?
No, Judy, I think, ironically, it's Bernie Sanders' moment after that interview. I mean, if anything has laid bare the income inequality, the economic inequality and disparity in this country, beginning with health care. 10 million people, I don't know how many million of them have lost their health care in the last 3 weeks. But what Bernie Sanders talked about is laid bare before us right now. I will say what Dave, following up David's point about a confidence growing, it is, but it's growing in an interesting way in governors, in mayors, in local government, less so in the federal government, less so in the president. Confidence in the president is not. And I think it's fascinating that governors who have daily television shows have done very well. Mike DeWine in Ohio is at 80% approval. Chris Sununu in New Hampshire, Republican, is at 73%, with 61% of Democrats rating him favorably. Donald Trump is not. Why? Very simply because his daily doses, his substitute for his rallies, are full of self-pity, full of invective, full of put-downs of those around him, of complaints that he's not getting the appreciation and attention that he should get. And contrast that with the governors who are providing empathy, direction, information, encouragement, and facts. And I really think there's a distinct difference, and people see it.
And David, what's your assessment of the president? He is holding these daily briefings, which sometimes run two and a half hours. And now he is talking about announcing next week what he's calling a get back to an opening up commission, open the country up council, if you will. Is this what the country needs to hear at this point?
I think it is, actually. We need to know what phase two is. We know we're going to hunker down for a while. We got to know what the world is going to look like when we come out of this. And there are no good plans out there. The plans that are circulating, there are a lot of private plans. They tend to focus on massive amounts of testing, way more tests than we have right now. And then tracing, where you have an app on your phone and somebody, the government, I don't know who, Bill Gates, would track where you go, who you came into contact with. And if you contacted somebody with the virus, then they would let you know and you'd self-isolate. That kind of pulling out of this is incredibly daunting, but it's something we're going to have to figure out as we slowly emerge from this. And so I'm glad the president's setting up this committee. The problem is, as I've been told, is that everybody on that committee has to be 100% loyal. And so if you said anything nasty about Donald Trump, you don't qualify for the committee. And that basically guarantees a very low level of competence from that committee. The North Korean style, you know, loyalty tests are going to be crushing to the competence of any effort going forward.
Interesting, because when the president was asked about it today, he said he was not paying attention, Mark, to anyone's political identification, whether they belong to the Republican or the Democratic Party.
And Judy, at which point did his nose start to grow? I mean, this is all the president has done since he was acquitted from the impeachment, is to settle scores, to go after career professionals, dedicated professional public servants who had given honest testimony. And because they did so, they're fired, they're suspended, they're ostracized, they're humiliated. We have a loyalty administration at this point. And that's one reason, Judy, why the next deal with Congress, it becomes almost impossible. Steve Mnuchin, the press secretary, had worked very well with Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic speaker, but he can't deliver Donald Trump. I mean, his word doesn't mean anything. Steve Mnuchin says, but Donald Trump, as soon as the ink was even dry on the last legislation, he refused to honor the legislation and the obligation of oversight that the Congress has when you're spending trillions of dollars. So, I mean, I really think that it's a we're in a grave situation in terms of leadership.
One other thing I want to ask you about that involving the president, David, and that is his firing over the past week of two inspectors general, and one over the intelligence community, the other one at the Pentagon, overseeing how this money is being spent to fight the pandemic. What do we learn from that?
Well, it's more North Korean loyalty tests. It's a political vendetta, straight and simple, and you got to be a total loyalist. I'm reminded that in World War II, there was the Truman Committee led by Harry Truman, which was the president's own party, had this committee, which did everything on a bipartisan census to crack down on profiteering and war profiteering, and phenomenally successful. And people in their own party were willing to look at the administration if they could save some money, if they could save lives, if they could fight the war more effectively. And we apparently are not going to be able to get that. And so when I look at the challenges facing us, one of them is just social trust. We have to have faith in our institutions, which means there has to be oversight, and we have to have faith in each other. With a lack of social trust, it's really hard to get anything done. And you see that on Capitol Hill right now, where the Senate and the Republicans and Democrats can't figure out what to put first, these small business loans or the public health loans. If we had a trusting institution, we'd say, okay, we'll do one, then we'll do the other. We're not going to have a big fight about it. But we lack that elemental social trust.
Mark, a quick word about the Inspector General decision.
It's obvious. It's part of the vendetta. This is a president who feels totally aggrieved and totally liberated from the post-impeachment. And I guess it doesn't come as a surprise probably to those who were in favor of the impeachment that this is what he's doing. I mean, he's going after such trusted and respected professionals and accusing them of petty partisanship, which is totally a bogus charge and unfair. And not only libeling their reputations, but in many cases, ending their careers.
I want to ask you both about Bernie Sanders. We talked about that at the beginning and his ideas for Medicare for all. We heard him say, David, he's going to be supporting Joe Biden, even though he knows that Biden is not going to embrace this. And this is Sanders' top priority. How do you assess his decision to suspend?
Well, it was inevitable. He had two problems. One, the party is a little to the center where he is. And two, he was never really good at working with other people. And so he wasn't able to build a coalition. I think the thing that's inspiring about Sanders, whether you agree with him or not, here's a guy who is fighting for a cause and has fought for it for decades, 5 or 6 decades. And he's never budged. He's been in the wilderness for decades. And his moment has arrived, to be honest. And so he's created a movement. He's given a new generation a voice. It's a very impressive accomplishment to just stick to it. And I imagine he's still in it for the long game, whether he's president or not, that some of his ideas will come to fruition with a new generation.
How much influence, Mark, do you think he's going to have on the Biden campaign?
Well, I think he's already having influence. I mean, we see the Senator, former Vice President, former Senator Biden moving already on college and $15 an hour minimum wage. I mean, Bernie Sanders dominated the dialogue of the last 5 years of the Democratic Party, and it was a signal achievement what he achieved in bringing crowds of people, of raising money from more people than any candidate, I believe, in the history of the Democratic Party, individual contributors, just absolutely remarkable. And he set the terms of the debate. I do agree that the fatal flaw were two things, one within his control and the other outside. His campaign was never one of welcoming people who had differed with him in the past. There was almost a litmus test. If you'd been wrong on NAFTA or wrong on Iraq, you were somehow considered unacceptable. By many of Bernie's most ardent supporters, certainly. And the second thing is, once the virus hit and once our pandemic hit, he was frozen in ice. All the things that a candidate could do to show movement and support, whether it was rallies or speeches or hand-to-hand campaigning, was gone. And I think he accepted that. I accept him at his word. The toughest thing in the candidate, Judy, is not running and losing. It's admitting that it's over. And I think Joe Biden is showing great sensitivity by giving him both praise and time to heal.
Well, we appreciate both of you tonight, Mark Shields, David Brooks. Thank you, and please stay safe, both of you.
Thank you.
Many of us are spending more time in our kitchens these days under shelter-in-place rules, forcing us to make fewer grocery runs and get creative with what's in the pantry. For advice on cooking in the times of COVID-19, William Brangham talked to someone who knows how to make the best of the ingredients on hand. It's part of our ongoing coverage of arts and culture, Canvas.
This is just really simple caramel sauce.
Ina Garten is one of the most beloved cooks in America. Her Barefoot Contessa books are instant bestsellers, known for their accessible and easy recipes. She's got a legion of TV fans, too, who have made her show on the Food Network a longtime hit.
You're a cook, right?
Yeah. I first met Garten 3 years ago at her home in East Hampton.
So I'm just going to pour this on top.
But now, in more difficult times, I wanted to check back with the Barefoot Contessa. Ina Garten, welcome back to the NewsHour.
Thank you, William. I'm so happy to be here with you.
So nice to see you, too. Can you first off just tell us, how are you doing?
It goes back and forth. I think I try and keep as normal a life as I can. I'm really lucky that I work at home. I'm really lucky that I live with somebody I want to live with, which is wonderful. But every once in a while, it creeps in and you think, oh, my goodness, this is overwhelming. What's happening outside and what's happening to people and how long is this going to go on for? And then you just shut it down. And I do as much as I can to try and keep my life as normal as possible.
Do you follow the news? Are you trying to limit your intake of news about what's going on?
I'm limited to PBS NewsHour, actually.
You're just saying that.
No, I'm not. I just can't stand to do it all day. But for 1 hour, I can do it.
And some people have been noticing recently how your Instagram page, which is obviously one of the principal ways you're communicating with your legion of fans, has changed in some ways, has become more personal. It feels like it's even more of a direct connection to you. Has that been intentional on your part?
It actually happened organically. In the beginning, I thought, how can I connect with people and give them some tools to make themselves feel better? And so I thought, well, maybe I'll make something for my pantry. And it started becoming like this town hall where people could ask me the question and I could answer them. And I actually felt very connected to people, what problems they had that maybe I could help solve. But the other thing that happened was it gave me purpose and order. Like every morning I would wake up and think, I'm going to find out something that people are having a hard time with and I'm going to make it.
There is certainly a yearning for people now. Everyone is cooped up at home, and we asked for questions from viewers about things, and that was something that came up over and over again. What is in your pantry that's a must-have that you think that is crucial for meals anytime?
Well, I think a lot of things like dried beans and rice and lentils and legumes that last for a long time. I also have things in my freezer, which I usually don't use my freezer at all, but I love making a big pot of chicken stock. Makes me feel good, makes the house smell good. It feels familiar. And then I store it in the freezer so I can make soups and stews.
So many people wrote in asking about this issue of substitutions because we're not just going to the grocery store every day. So give your audience some freedom about substitutions. If you don't have X, what can you do? If you don't have Y, what can you do?
Of course you can make substitutions. You don't have shallots, use onions. If you don't have garlic, use ginger. If you don't, all of a sudden I'm finding myself doing exactly the same thing, and it's going to inform every other book that I write. I made a frittata the other day. It was a potato basil frittata. I had no basil, so I used scallions. And you know what? It was the best frittata I'd ever made. Something like weeknight bolognese, which is pasta with a tomato sauce, and you can really put anything you want in it. If you don't have ground beef, you can grab turkey, or if somebody's vegetarian, you can use diced mushrooms. Are absolutely delicious. So I think I'm always big on if everybody around the table has different appetites, I find one thing that everybody can eat. I think more and more I want the dinners to feel like a party, because we're really kind of craving that, aren't we? We want to feel like we're having a good time. And I think if you have people around you, or even if you don't, if you're on your own and do a Zoom, party on Zoom, you feel like you're still connected to people. That's the one thing that I really crave, and I just don't know how I'm going to get through months and months of not having it, is my friends. So I do, in the beginning, I started on FaceTime and Zoom, and what I found is I wanted to take my telephone and just curl up on my sofa with a blanket and talk to a friend in an old-fashioned way, the way we used to talk on the phone, and that I find satisfying. Baking's really satisfying. I find cooking really stressful, but I find it totally engaging, and I forget that there's something bigger going on outside. Are you surprised that I find cooking stressful?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Did you get that, viewers? Ina Garten finds cooking stressful?
I find it really totally engaging, and I'm highly alert when I'm cooking. And that's kind of a good place to be.
Right, it keeps your focus. You keep focused on one thing, and in some ways, the outside world dissolves away.
For a while, yeah. And then you end up with something delicious to serve.
When all of this is over and we're back to not being social distance from each other and people get back to some semblance of normalcy, is there something that you hope people take from this experience that they inject into their regular lives?
I think one thing that we're doing is appreciating the everyday things in life. A delivery of flowers, a kindness by a neighbor. I think it's not about success and collecting things. I think it's really about staying close to people that are important to you. And it would be great if we kept that.
Those are beautiful, obviously important words. Ina Garten, thank you so much for being here. Great to see you again.
Great to see you, William. Thank you so much for having me.
And we're all going to head to the pantry this weekend. Thank you, William. And thank you to Ina Garten. And we will be back right here on Monday with a focus on this pandemic and the intersection with poverty in the hotspot of Detroit. That's the NewsHour for tonight. Have a great weekend. I'm Judy Woodruff, and please stay safe.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by
Life isn't a straight line, and sometimes you can find yourself heading in a new direction. Fidelity is here to help you work through the unexpected with financial planning and advice for today and tomorrow.
BNSF Railway. Consumer Cellular. Financial services firm Raymond James. The William and Flora Hewlett Foundation. For more than 50 years, advancing ideas and supporting institutions to promote a better world at Hewlett.org.
Supporting social entrepreneurs and their solutions to the world's most pressing problems. SkollFoundation.org.
And with the ongoing support of these institutions. And friends of the NewsHour. This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you.
You're watching PBS.